Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy connecting the light. I have to say I'm back after a very restful and peaceful week, so I'm feeling fully energized to interview Laura Ketchledge, who's waiting to speak with us. She is a psychic and paranormal author, and I don't know if she's made it yet, but I did read that she was making a paranormal movie. So welcome to the program, Laura.
Well, thank you, and I'm delighted to be on your show today. Thank you.
Are you making a paranormal movie soon?
Yes, I am. I'm making, I wanted to do something really, really fun and take a departure from doing serious writing, so I thought I would make a movie, and it's entitled Another Apocalyptic Zombie Movie, and it's sort of, let's say, Blazing Saddles meets Dawn of the Dead. How does that grab you?
Oh, really interesting. Well, having read little extracts from your books, if it's as good as your books, it'll be excellent.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to do something light and comedic.
Right, yes. Well, you've had a pretty interesting life, I must say. Where do we start with you? It goes back, does it not, to 1994 or earlier? And I mentioned 1994 because that was, I believe, when you had your near-death experience.
No, I had my accident back in 1979 when I was 19 years old.
Oh,
so
right.
I guess that dates me. That makes me a very hard 50.
Hmm.
But I had the accident. I fell off the horse going very fast on my and fell face first into a ditch, and I was killed. And I had a near-death experience. And I was resuscitated, or we wouldn't be having this conversation. And the amazing thing is, when I came back, not only did I come back with, you know, the knowledge and the memory of my near-death experiences, that after the accident, I saw my first ghost. And it was
wow.
Really upsetting. I got up and ran. I was just terrified. In fact, I thought I was having a schizophrenic break or a brain tumor, and I went to a doctor and just threw myself on the couch and thought I was going mad. And, you know, I wasn't. I had, I brought back with me some psychic ability.
Right. Now, you fell off the horse and you died, and you know you died because you suddenly came to in a different situation. I mean, what was your first sort of reaction? What happened?
Well, what happened was, you know, the horse is going away with me and pretty fast, and I knew I was going to fall. You know, you get that feeling of dread, and you know that something terrible is going to happen to your body, and there's no way to get around it. I fell, and I never had the impact of the ground. I never hit the ground because I was literally out of my body, going down a deep, black, dark tunnel or pit. And when I came out, it's more involved than that, but I'm trying to say simple things to express something that's inexpressible. I went into a place that was not physical reality. It was the next, you know, the other side, or what you should call. And I had, I saw what my life really was, and I wasn't too happy with what I saw. And I talked to my grandfather, and I had a long conversation with him. And it seemed, you know, as far as events that we did together, that I was there a very, very long time, but I wasn't dead 2 minutes. Mm. The time is not exactly applicable over there as it is here. And as I was coming back, the thing that was horrifying me most, the troubling me most, was when I came back, I didn't want to return. I wanted to stay there, and I fought it. And when I got resuscitated, everyone, you know, at the hospital, you're such a lucky girl, you're such, this is so wonderful. I was pretty agitated for, it took me about 12 hours to calm down.
you thought you were joking, I wanted to stay.
Pretty much,
right.
I guess it was a better deal over there.
Well, in fact, I've read quite a number of near-death experiences, and I would say without exception, that seems to be what everyone has thought. It's so nice that they think, why do I want to come back? Now, you spoke to your grandfather,
yeah.
And did he say to you, this isn't really your time, you have to go back?
No, we talked about, well, it was more than that. I mean, I was telling him my thoughts and you know, how I feeling, how much I loved him. It was a necessity that I would go back. It wasn't, you should go back, this is your destiny. It was a true necessity that I come back. And, you know, I fought it. I fought it tooth and nail until I was there. And I remember opening my eyes and looking at this beautiful field that I was, you know, and these people working over me to see that I survived. And I felt anger towards these men, you know, that, you know, I was very angry and irritated with them. And I didn't want to be bothered with them. And I looked, and I mean, it was such a beautiful day, and I remember this so vividly. And my thoughts were, this is not reality.
Right. Now, in some senses, I would say you had to come back, in as much as I suspect they told you that you had things to do, so therefore you felt obliged to carry out your life plan. Would that be correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not a perfect person. I'm not one of these saints. I'm sort of like a good works in progress, you know. I'm a flawed character like most people. Did it make me a better person? I don't know, but it sure gave me an understanding, an ethic of right and wrong. And I had this urgency, and I still have it, that I want to get my life right, because I don't want my life to be for nothing. I want it to have meaning. And I don't want to get reincarnated and have to be 13 again and go through the same set of trials and tribulations.
Now, I announce, which you say you are, psychic. Did you have psychic experiences right from being a child then?
Well, my grandmother and her people, you know, from Canada and Wales, my great-grandmother had the gift, and sometimes people would come to her, and she'd lay their hands on them, and, you know, she would heal them. And this is the turn of the century. This is 110 years ago. So I had two uncles that also had it, but they had their gift or their abilities different. I didn't find this out till I was 30, until I was struggling with my own psychic experiences. I wish someone had told me sooner. But I think the thing that makes it kind of remarkable and kind of weird is that, you know, this zigzagged through my family, and I was told as a toddler that I may have had psychic contact, because I kept, when I was a little girl, my mother or grandmother would put me in the crib, and then I would point to the ceiling and say this name and point to somebody, and I would put my hands over my head when I was asked, and they'd say, well, who was that? And I would say, ball people.
Mm.
And, you know, things like that. But I don't have a recollection of it. It's just a kind of a hypothesis of mine.
Right. So you were probably seeing people in spirit, and as a young child, you thought everybody else could as well.
But, you know, possibly. I got it real early, you know. I was shut down real early, because on my father's side, you know, we've got my grandfather was a minister, and my father's a very, you know, practical man. So anything I did have psychically was pretty much squished. But I didn't have anything, you know, as a kid up until really this accident at 19, and then everything changed.
Right. So you progressed from there to the time you had your near-death experience, and then that clearly changed your life in some way. You say that you're intuitive. You, for example, know when something's going to happen. Has that stayed with you?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's times that I've had dreamt of somebody or thought about somebody and then run into him, like, the next day or a few hours later. In fact, I was thinking about somebody I knew in New York City, of all places, walking down Times Square, and ran into them, and I hadn't seen them in years. You know, little things like that. But I wasn't psychic enough to think, to meet my husband and say, ooh, that's not a guy I should marry. Nothing like that. I mean, I haven't gotten, you know, the lotto numbers, and I, you know, I make jokes about that, because, listen, if I could, I would. But the remarkable thing is that when I get these intuitions, you know, they seem to come out of nowhere, and they seem to be very, very important.
Hmm. Well, I guess where your husbands are concerned, you might well have accepted anyone then.
Well, that's just a joke between, you know, I'm just trying to be a little bit humorous.
Right.
I never could tell a joke very well.
Right. Now, a lot of your experiences are obviously in the three novels that you've written, because you talk about the near-death connection, which I assume is really related to your own experience. So how much of you is in those novels?
Well, what I've done is taken my own psychic experience and insights and put them into, you know, fictional characters living in a pretend world. But once you read the near-death connection, once it's published and you've read it, you will feel like you've had one. It's that explicit. I put into so many details, and I write so precise what it is like to have a near-death experience. You know, your feelings, your rush, you know, this horrible fear that sweeps through your body as you're leaving it, and, you know, fear of the unknown. I mean, it's like being thrown into the middle of the ocean in the middle of the night. And then all of a sudden this tremendous exhilaration when you meet somebody that has died that you really, really love. And it's very, very intense. And I've tried to put that in my book, and I've tried to put a plot line and interesting characters, and it's the beginning of a series. So if you don't like that book, you might like Throw Away Horses or The Reincarnation of Tess Hamilton, which are the books that follow the near-death connection.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a nice way to get the information over to people. Now, in the near-death experience, I only read an extract, but I gather it's about a young girl who nearly died, and she went back to her previous life as Jane. Have I got the correct idea?
Well, what I had to do in my book previews on my website is I couldn't tell crucial things that would mess up the plot line or kill the surprise in the books. But I took one of my minor characters. There's this group of people that come to this home, and each one of them have had a near-death experience. And when this one character, Jane Lindstrom, I call her plain Jane Lindstrom because, you know, she works for the IRS, she wears polyester pantsuit, and she's never had a date. And when she was a little girl, as an adult, she remembers being a little girl in her past life and how she died. And, you know, things that were very applicable of the 1890s. When someone had pneumonia, they used to take a piece of paper, light it on fire, and then put a glass right over it, you know, on your chest to draw out the illness. You know, those little superstitions. She heard her sisters jump rope in the background, you know, and, you know, having a tune, peas porridge hot, peas porridge cold, things that kids would skip rope to, you know, in the 1800s. So
right.
Jane realizes she had a past life, and then when she comes back, she really wonders what happened to those family members because in that brief moment, she loved them.
Mm-hmm. So did you research that period of time to make your novel more realistic?
Oh, yes. I am a tremendous history buff. I studied Civil War for fun and go to reenactments. It sounds a little bit dry and not too exciting, but I like it. So I took a character and made him a Civil War historian, Robert Hampton, and living in Northern Virginia. And he teaches, of course, all about the Civil War. He's a Civil War historian, and he goes around collecting all these cats and giving him a home, and then he names them different, you know, Civil War generals or heroes. Like, you've got Rooney Lee and Jubal Early as his cats, and he has quite a character. I have characters in my books that are in their 40s and 50s, and they're very, very interesting. It's not all, you know, when you write a, quote, paranormal novel, it's not all about a 20-year-old girl in peril. You know, you've got a lot of layers and a lot of good characters that are over 25, shall we say.
Mm. Right, so does that have a happy ending, the near-death experiences?
Well, parts of it do, parts of it it doesn't. It has a very surprise ending, a very, very, you'll want to go to the next book. So I believe that I put a lot of drama page for page, and, you know, they're definitely page turners. At the end of the series, I'm writing one more book right now, and at the end of that, it's sort of like a re-intersection of all these people that you meet in 1979, and you see what they do in 1981 in the second book, and in 1983 to 1987, and then you've got, you know, as this jumps along, you've got, you've grown attached to these characters. They've gotten older. Some of them have gotten wiser. But the paranormal journey that they all take is quite interesting, and the ending is going to be definitely nobody's going to see this one coming.
Right. Now, you have another novel called The Reincarnation of Tess.
Yes.
And that is at some stage based in London during the World War II and the bombing, and it's quite a graphic little bit I've read. But then, how did it happen that suddenly she had a vision and saw a wounded Union man? How did that fit into the story?
Well,
was that part of the near-death experience?
Yeah, the Tess Hamilton character is a minor character in the first book. A little bit in the second book, but in the third book, it's basically her book, The Reincarnation of Tess Hamilton. It's got part one and two. And
right.
She dies. And she has a complete or a semi-complete recount of her past lives. One is, you know, little Beatrice Cavendish, and the other one is Abigail Cantrell. And the little girl that we find the night that she died at, you know, 6 years old, and we go through that and during the Battle of Britain, and it's quite sad. I mean, it's kind of sad in the end. I don't want to give out too much, but the kid doesn't make it. But she has all the recollection and all the knowledge a little girl living during World War II would have at that age. You know, the way she talks. You know, little things like, you know, that you're British, you'll take for granted, but the Americans, we don't call a flashlight a torch. Just little intricacies, you know, that really make it real. And I did quite a bit of history reading, and then I did her past life as Abigail Cantrell, which is pretty explicit, takes place during the Civil War, but she has a different perspective because she lives in a border state. You know, she lives in the state of Maryland and then Kentucky, and it all centers around the Battle of Perryville. And I did extensive research into that. I mean, went to some reenactments, read a dozen books, toured historical houses, and it sounds quite nerdy, but I really had a good time doing it. So that was pretty joyful project. The ending is kind of ambiguous, but I hope that when I do get a publisher and that these are published, that these will be turned into movies, because that's the format it's written in.
Yes, would make good movies, I would imagine. Do you know any of your previous lives as a matter of interest?
Well, I had written about, you know, this Tess story, and I'd always been, you know, and people would talk about, you know, oh, I remember my life as so-and-so, and I always joked, I thought, well, you know, if I had a past life, you know, maybe I lived in Cleopatra's time, but I was definitely her maid. You know, I wasn't anybody important. And I used to laugh about this a lot, about reincarnation, because I'm writing the book, and it took a couple years to write it. Then I started, you know, doing some Hemisync Robert Monroe tapes, you know, CDs from the Monroe Institute, try to felicitate some of my psychic contact. And I've been doing them for about 4 years, and sometimes it's successful, sometimes it isn't, but be careful what you ask for. Because in one of the exercises, I was just kind of going through it blindly, and I'd done it like, I don't know, 30 times, and the question was, who was I before I was me? Well, be careful what you ask for, because I did that, I didn't feel anything. That night, I know this sounds like crazy talk, because I'm such a level person, but this psychic thing, you know, it is what it is, and I've got no control, and it doesn't come with direction. So I met my mother for the first time, my mother in my past life, and I saw her, like, from the chest up, you know, like the shoulders up. I didn't see her body. She's heavy set. She kind of had big hair. Older, not exactly slim lady. Anyways, I didn't feel like I recognized her, feel that I love her. I didn't feel like I didn't love her. So she looked at me and she said, I was your mother. Your name was Ellen. A jealous boyfriend murdered you in 1942. Well, that was a zinger. What do you think? Hello?
Very explosive
okay.
stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that happened, and I was very shaken up, and I didn't know what to do about it. And I was up all night, and I thought, well, I better write this down. But, you know, actually, I couldn't forget it if I wanted to. So that was my only encounter with her. So 2 days later, I'm at the YMCA. I'm walking in the therapy pool for the arthritis. And, you know, just minding my own business in the middle of the day. And I was flashed, or what I call, got a message. I was presented a picture. Sometimes when you ask questions or sometimes you will get pictures. I guess it's telepathic. I'm really not great on the psychic verbiage because I don't keep up with other people. But I saw Eleanor. I saw what she looked like, that she had red hair parted on the side, smallish blue eyes, plump cheeks. She was young, you know, under 30, over 18. I saw what I looked like, and I got to say, I was not a beauty. And you know what? I haven't been able to get any more information or contact. So being so frustrated and being so poor in my computer skills, I've asked readers, because I write for several online magazines, to, you know, if you can help me find Eleanor when I do my next movie, The Accidental Psychic, I'll give you a speaking part in it. So the offer goes, if we can find Eleanor. But I didn't get the last name, but I did get the fact that she was murdered, and she was murdered in 1942, and that she was Caucasian, and I guess that's an Anglo-Saxon name, Eleanor. So I'm guessing that she has got to either be American, Canadian, British, or perhaps Australian. I don't know.
Right.
That's a very long yes to your question.
Yeah. I have to tell you, when I was about 11 and I began to realize that I wasn't really my body, I remember asking my parents the same thing that you said, who was I before I was me? But they couldn't answer it. So that's interesting. I think it's something that comes to you after a time. Right, let's move on to Throwaway Horses, which is about Joe Dan and the subject of the slaughterhouse. That sounds interesting, because you said it was built over the grounds of a massacre that took place.
An Indian massacre. Well, you know, this is fiction, but it's based on some reality. I have a character, Sharon Landry, and in any of my novels, if there is one person that is Laura Kethledge, it's definitely Sharon Landry. We're both little train wrecks. And I love writing about her, because she's over 40, and she's interesting, and she's funny, and she's sort of a disaster, which kind of parallels my life. But anyways, I grew up in Ormond Beach, Florida, in the 1960s. Great place to live. So I decided that when Sharon is going to reveal her big secret that she's intimated in the first novel, she tells Robert and Ellen, you know, this story about when she was young. So I'll take the reader back to 1959, Ormond Beach, Florida, what it looked like, every detail about it, and it was a different time. It was a time when, you know, saying grace was part of your meal. The milkman still delivered milk, and the man on the moon was science fiction. It was a different era, and North Florida has its own flavor, its own personality in the United States. But Sharon kind of has this adventure and runs into the slaughterhouse in a mythical town named Ouchalucola outside of Jacksonville, Florida, on the bay. And there is a slaughterhouse built over where there had been a Seminole Indian massacre. So you kind of find really why the place has haunted and why there are ghost horses from the slaughterhouse. And what I did is I worked with a USDA and got some information on PETA, so I was pretty precise about how the slaughterhouses work, and it was kind of grim and it was kind of gross, but there was a message about it, about horse slaughter, how animals are stolen, horses are stolen from the owner's backyards and go to the meat factory. It's pretty brutal American tale here. And it's true, and it's still going on. So it's probably the only story where I'm a little bit preachy and I have an epilogue at the end, but it makes a great mystery, and it's a whodunit wrapped in a paranormal story.
Yes, and indeed, it is a fact, which I'm sure you know, that where you have had an incident like that, where there's a lot of negative energy, it seems to be held within the earth, and if they built the slaughterhouse over it, they would continue then to add to that energy or keep it going.
Yes, I think that sometimes where there's something traumatic happened, you know, I've often wondered if that is why the house I'm living in has had ghostly visitations. In fact, I've had two teams of paranormal investigators come to my house outside of Lexington, Kentucky, and both have found EVPs, electronic voice phenomena, which was kind of a newbie to me. But and the reason is there is a lost Civil War cemetery on my street.
Oh.
And there's a schoolhouse, because this is a Wheat School Road, and on the schoolhouse was a makeshift field hospital after the Battle of Perryville, which was the great battle of Kentucky that most people don't know about.
Right. Well, that would give it good reason to attract ghosts, wouldn't it?
Well, I had an interesting one this summer, and but it wasn't Civil War related. He was just there. I wasn't the bravest person, I have to admit, but, you know, I did the best I could with what I had.
Right. I'd certainly like to talk about the Haunted House Farm, but let's first cover your, well, I think it's the last book, The Last House on Covington Lane. And it's, I gather, about a guy called Frank who is infatuated with obviously a beautiful lady called Sharon. And when he planned to break in, and I think he was even prepared to kidnap her, he was stopped at different points by people that appeared in spirit. And in the end, he was so frightened, he ran off. I think it's a very good storyline.
Well, thank you. In that story, which is the second half of the second book, Sharon Landry's book, really, you sure don't see that coming. Frank is kind of skulking in the background, and he's a jilted boyfriend, even though he wasn't a serious boyfriend, but he's kind of off his rocker, and he comes to, you know, really do Sharon harm, and when he starts to break in the lock, this ghost appears, and he says, "You're not coming in this house," and then when he turns to his side, you know, he drops his tools, another one comes, this woman wearing a 1920s maid uniform, that the woman that was killed down in the Coquina Hotel in Ormond Beach, Florida, has come to Virginia, you know, to protect Sharon Landry, unbeknownst to her. And she says, "You're not taking our Sharon." And then the third ghost comes and does something a little more drastic, because she has a grandmother's rage. Yeah.
That was Charlotte, the third one.
Yeah, Charlotte.
Yeah.
And she's in Throwaway Horses too.
Oh, right. I'm beginning to gather, obviously, the fact, as you're talking, that there's a link between the novels. I didn't realise that at first, having only read the extracts. I think that's rather a clever way to do it. So people get familiar with your characters, and then they keep coming up in the different novels.
Yes, I'll take a minor character and make them more of a central character in the next novel.
Right,
so,
yeah, that's good.
But the people are, you know, kind of, and then you see them age, you know, over a 30-year period, a lot of things happen to in their lives.
Oh, yes. Well, that's interesting. Right, let's come back to your Haunted House Farm. I'm sure we have a lot of listeners who are very interested in this. Now, you have called them ghosts, but I think in reality they are all spirits that are not necessarily earthbound, but some may be. So would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I guess ghost is a generic term. I always say the formerly alive and the recently dead. I try to make a little joke out of it. But, yes, there are spirits that have come to this house, visitations, direct conversations that I've had. And I would say it's happened, I've lived here 8 years, over 100 times. But I'm pretty comfortable with it, and I find it comforting. I think that spirits are the deceased that come to me, They're helpful. They're caring. It's nothing malevolent. It's nothing bad. I've had a couple scary things, but they usually were my misinterpretations, my being startled, you know, or fear of the unknown.
Do they come to you asking you to contact their relatives, or is it purely that they have a chat with you just like a friend?
Well, I think they've come, you know, sometimes when I have done these Monroe tapes, because I haven't kept up with the paranormal world out there. I've sort of written my books quietly. I never came out of the closet till last summer about my psychic abilities, because I figured it would lend authenticity to my books, and then I, you know, have to say, you know, this did come from somewhere. Had I not been an author, I never would have been talking about this to anybody. But I think that the ghosts that come to see me are coming for me. Personal, kind, sometimes mentoring. Other times, you know, they'll answer questions like in a picture, or I guess that's telepathically. And I've also heard their voices. So it's been a variety. And, you know, I struggle for my interpretation. I still struggle.
Right. I suppose in all possibility, the fact they come to you means that perhaps in some life they have known you before.
Yes. I was still freaked out that my mother came to see me. I had always, you know, I believed in the theory of reincarnation, but I wasn't a big, you know, advocate of it, and I really didn't want to hear other people's stories. I just wasn't that interested. But until it happened to me, did I realize it's a known. It wasn't a belief. It became a known or a truth. I don't like the fact that I was murdered and I died young. I guess I reincarnated pretty quick if I came into 1959. That's when I was born.
Yes.
But I don't remember being Eleanor. I don't have any connection. You know, I didn't feel anything when I met my mother, and I kind of feel bad about that because I always assumed that there would be more. But there may be more, but not at this time.
Well, I suspect when you pass over, as we all will at some time, when we meet our loved ones, I think the bond will be felt then.
Yes, so do I.
Right.
I think one of the most comforting things is, you know, I've seen my grandfather, you know, after the near-death experience. I saw him and had a complete conversation with him in 1985, and I've seen him since, and I'm just thrilled that he hasn't, you know, forgotten about me or moved away from me, and I still feel him close from time to time, which, hey, in my book, that is great. That's a win-win.
Oh, yes. That's beautiful indeed. Now, you've got a big house and a very big area around it, and you have horses. Now, it's often said that animals are probably more sensitive and psychic than we are. Do they react to the ghosts at all?
Well, you know, my horses are really old. I've got a 29-year-old, and then I've got one that I saved from slaughter. She's well over 33. We don't know. So I don't think they've been too close to the house that I remember that when I've had a ghost encounter. But I wouldn't, you know, be surprised, you know, if they had been closer, that there's some sort of reaction. My dogs have reacted at some times, and then other times they slept right through the event.
Yeah, well, I guess that really is a yes answer.
Yeah,
I think there's no doubt that animals are sensitive. I must say, you've got a nice computer room, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I've got all these old-time pictures up from the 1920s in there. I thought, you know, because I couldn't afford a public relations person, I know this sounds kind of funny, and you have to have that before you can get a publisher. You have to be a known person. So if you're an aspiring author, it's really tough. So I put my house on eBay as haunted and said I'd take a lie detector test. And boy, wouldn't you know, in 3 days I had all the local media here and two teams of ghost investigators. But the ghost investigators did find positive EVPs and positive paranormal activity. They also said it centered around me a great deal. And they asked me, has this happened to you in other homes? And I said, well, since the time I was 23, it's happened in every home I've lived in. So either the ghosts are traveling and coming with me, or I'm just I'm popular. I don't know what to say.
Yes. I think undoubtedly that is the case. As you said, over the other side, things are a little bit different. So as you move around, I don't know that they necessarily would be aware of that because they're connected with you, aren't they, not the places.
Well, I think that this place might be connected. There's something more, I think, in this house because I had been having these terrible dreams about someone breaking in through my bedroom window, and it wasn't an anxiety dream. It was maybe a premonition. Well, last summer, I woke up at 2 a.m., and there was a man coming through the window, and, of course, I screamed. I didn't go for the phone. And I went to close the window, and his hands were through, and I looked down at his hands, and he kept saying, "Let me in." And his hands were white, you know, devoid of any pigmentation. But I could, you know, see that his nails were cut short, and he had very large hands and long fingers. And then he said to me, and I saw him, he said, "Tell me when I can go back to work." And all of a sudden, my fear left, and I had some empathy and compassion because I realized he was confused. And then the next second, he was standing to the side of the house and walking in a circle, and he was wearing clothes like, you know, like a canvas type, you know, pant that you would wear at a farm and work boots and a long sleeve, like blue jean type shirt that was untucked. I mean, I got a really clear view of him, and he was a very tall, lean man and, you know, white hair, but everything was white, so I couldn't tell you if he had hair color. He was older. He was so lost and forlorn and just beside himself. I said, "Wait a minute, hon, I'll be right outside." And I meant to go outside, but something inside, even though I knew he was a ghost and I knew he needed help, I just sat in my bed for about an hour. I just really was unable to move. And then finally I grabbed the flashlight and the dog and went out to the side yard, and he was gone, and he hasn't been back. But I don't know if he's, well, there's one thing. A couple of times someone had a ghost or spirit have knocked on that same pane of glass on that window and woken me up. And I'm, you know, like a, you know, bat out of hell. It's like, ah! And they've woken me up, but I don't know what for or if I'm missing something.
No.
But that ghost there did shake me up.
Yes, indeed it would. I don't think we would like that, to hear noises when we're not expecting it. Now, just getting back to your teams of ghost hunters, were they simply trying to prove for you or for themselves that there was some paranormal things going on?
Oh, they were here to debunk me.
Oh, were they?
They were here to disprove me, which I loved. I had the Kentucky Spirit Seekers. They found me because they saw me on television. And I said all these, you know, funny kind of things about my house on TV, but of course they made me look very melodramatic. It was all edited out. So they came, the very professional people. They set up all this electronic equipment. They had me leave the house. They made sure everything was unplugged so there's no scam I was trying to pull. And they got positive EVPs even though they were only here about 3 hours. So you can hear different voices on the EVPs, and they're voices that I'm familiar with. And then the World Paranormal Investigations team came here from Ohio. It was about a five-hour trip for them. And they spent the night, and there was a whole team of investigators, and we did a seance. And I'm sitting there during the seance not feeling the love or feeling the psychic connection, but everybody else was. I think I was too nervous. And there was a cluster of shadows that danced across the wall, and they were taking pictures of them. It was very scientific. They're very high-tech. And I'm a person that, you know, can't even set the time on their microwave, you know. So,
yeah.
So these people were also high-tech, and I feel like, you know, this whole team of nerds knows everything but me. But they got positive EVPs. And during the seance, I asked a couple of questions, and in the EVPs, when we played it back, you could hear me asking the question and then hear someone softly say, "I died." And when somebody else was talking, you heard a "who." Not as many, there were more of a one-word or two-word answers, not as intricate as the ones in where the other team was. Both investigation teams wanted to come back or would like to come back at another later time, you know, to do this again. And I welcome any reputable team to come to my house. And I'll be glad to take a lie detector and a test. In fact, I would enjoy doing it, and I'll do it live on the radio as long as there's not needles and you don't ask me how much I weigh. I'll tell you everything else. I'll even give you my PIN number.
Right. Oh, well,
but I am honest. I mean, I can see ghosts.
You wouldn't have any worry with that, obviously. What I wanted to mention is you're running past Life Investigation on several online magazines. What does that mean? Do people write in and say, I dreamt or I know I was, whatever it was, and you give them some idea of the link between them? Or?
I have no ability to channel at all or do readings at all. I mean, I just don't even have that. And even if I did, I wouldn't do it because it's just too much responsibility. But I've asked other people, I've asked everybody, you know, in these articles, past life, present life puzzle, psychic Sherlock Holmes looking for my Watson, which is on UFO Digest, and there's links on my webpage, www.luraketch.com. I've asked people to help me find who I was before I was me, which is Eleanor. I don't know Eleanor's last name. I know that she was murdered, or I was murdered in 1942. I know my boyfriend did it, jealous boyfriend, and I know my name, but I really need that verification. I've tried to do stuff on the Internet really not very successfully. I've asked that, you know, for people to help me, and a couple of people have sent, you know, given me some clues. And I was even asked by one of them, well, how do you think Eleanor was murdered? And this is a hypothesis. This isn't anything but a gut feeling. I think that she was stabbed. I think I've always had a tremendous fear of knives or butcher knives. I could be wrong. I could have just been, you know, could be a neuroses that I picked up in my present life. But I have a feeling that she was stabbed, and I would like to find out who she was. I'd like verification. Even if nobody else in the world knew, I'd like to find out and everything I can about Eleanor, because I could possibly have children or siblings that are alive, and I'd like to meet them.
Oh, yes.
I don't know how I'd introduce myself, but I'd love to have the opportunity to meet them.
It's a pity that you don't know, say, for example, to narrow it down, which city or area that she lived in, isn't it?
Oh, man, I just, you know, I feel like it was almost a tease that I got some of the information, but not all. So I've done meditations asking, you know, what was my last name? Where did I live? How can I find her? I haven't, you know, it's been a year that I've been trying to, and I haven't broken through to the other side pertaining to Eleanor since. So it's a little frustrating and, you know, disappointing. I'm hoping that it's possible. I mean, you know, you hear about all these psychics on the television and the news and what, and they can do all these amazing things. And I don't know. I guess I feel a little shortchanged.
Right. Now, there's an article I came across called Lifeline from Beyond the Grave. Is that an article or something to do with the true life experience?
Oh, all my articles on that I write, you know, they're all first-person articles. This is that article that I wrote for Paranormal People. Is my grandfather saved my life when I was 34 years old. Would you like me to tell you about it?
Oh, always, yes.
Okay, I was very sick, and I had gone up to the Mayo Clinic and some other places, and they said that I had non-viral hepatitis, like inflammation of the liver, that was a very, very painful thing, but not life-threatening. And that I wasn't in any immediate danger whatsoever, but I was just going to be miserable. So I accepted that. I wasn't happy about it, and I really did have hepatitis, and I don't feel good. And then I started, a few more weeks into it, I was really, really tired, and it hurt awful bad, and I thought, gee, you know, this is a miserable thing. You know, how can this be so painful? So one morning, I woke up. And my grandfather was in my bedroom, and he walked over, and he sat next to me, and he put his hand not on but over my abdomen, and he said, your spleen, and then the event was over, and he was gone, and I didn't know what that meant, so I didn't know what to make of it. And then a few days later, I was laying in bed, and I was definitely awake. And I heard someone whisper in my left ear, spleen, spleen. Well, after the second time, and I know that there was another contact that I had with him that I wasn't really clear in because I was between being awake and being asleep. And sometimes, you know, that happens. So I got into a real panic mode, and I had this rush, this feeling come over me after that last encounter, and I heard in me saying to me, you're going to die if you don't have your spleen removed. So I went to the doctor who in Orlando who probably thought I was, you know, in a hypochondriac, and he said, I'm not running a second abdominal scan because your insurance won't pay for it. So I went to another surgeon, and doctor, and I looked at him. I said, you know, Gary, I've got to have a physician's order for a splenectomy. If I don't, I will die. And he was a little more open to the paranormal than you'd imagine. So he wrote me the order. He said, I'm going to write you the order, but I'm, you know, not going to do it. Finally got a surgeon to do it. And when they did the surgery, my spleen had been bleeding for weeks and had formed a huge blood clot, which was ready to break off and kill me. And, you know, the doctor said, he said, this is so unusual. Your spleen didn't expand it. It contracted and bled out. And he said it was a 1 in a million chance, you know, basically that I didn't bleed to death. And, you know, as I was laying in the hospital, I realized, number one, my grandfather came back from beyond the grave to save my life. And number two, I don't know if he did me a favor because it was an awful surgery. It was terrible. And, I just knew that one thing that, boy, I guess I wasn't ready yet, you know, and that he loved me enough to do this, you know.
Oh, you escaped death twice.
Yeah, I feel like the cat with nine lives. I'm running out.
Yes, absolutely. And I read that quite clearly that whole experience must have weakened you or affected your immunity because just to round it off, you got double pneumonia.
Yes. They put a pneumonia patient in my room. It was not good. It was not a good thing. I got double pneumonia in both lungs, very bad, and coughed and ripped most of the abdominal stitches. So I wasn't loving the world. It was pretty dicey.
Mm. But well, an experience.
Yeah, one I would not want to repeat. I didn't even know when I was hearing, when he told me your spleen, I didn't even know where in the human body your spleen was. I was surprised to find out later it was right by your liver.
Right, yes. Well, it's not many people that get a ghost, is it? Come and give them a diagnosis and save their life. It's a remarkable story, isn't it? If you aren't hearing it, I think, from the person who has experienced it, sometimes you would find it perhaps unbelievable. Now, we're getting near the end of the program. There's no panic yet. Just let me clear up one or two things. With these novels, did I hear you say that they haven't been published yet?
No, they haven't. I've been holding back to go to a publisher, doing a year of PR, doing radio, some television talking about it, because you have to have that firmly in place before a publisher will look at you. And I was fine-tuning the last one, so I can send out the series this summer to different publishers, so I'm crossing my fingers. And if you're a publisher, you know, go to my webpage and email me or call me. These are really, I think, very unique stories, very entertaining, and you will learn things about the psychic world firsthand from me.
Right. Now, clear up another point here. Have you a new email address? Because the one I tried to reach you on wasn't available, apparently.
Oh, my email is lura.ketch, K-E-T-C-H, @yahoo.com. Because my name is Laura Kesslidge, I abbreviated the last name, and my website is www.lura.ketch.com.
Right, that's great. Now, what advice would you give people that might feel that they're having minor ghostly experiences and don't know how to handle it? I mean, can they get rid of them? Can they stop them coming if it disturbs them?
Well, you know, if it's a negative experience, I think you need to change something in your life. I think that, you know, if you're getting a negative experience, you either need to move, have a team of the, you know, ghost people come and paranormal people give you assistance. But if you're having comforting and good experiences like myself, you need to kind of relax into it, you know, do some meditation and prayer. I always do kind of a little prayer to myself that I accept kind, warm, loving spiritual guides, and I reject all others, and I dismiss all negativity. I do my little chant. It makes me feel better. I don't know if it works or not, but...
Right, I'm sure it does. Yeah. Now, one time, I believe you were trying to sell your farm.
Well, I put it on eBay actually for publicity, and a few people were interested in it, but they didn't really care for the location because they lived in another state. It was an inconvenient location, but it's outside of Lexington, Kentucky. It's on my webpage. It's on Craigslist. If I don't sell it, that's fine. I like living here. It's a beautiful little farm, 5-acre farm. If I sell it, that's okay too. You know, goats included, but not guaranteed.
Do you charge extra for the ghosts?
I don't know. But I thought it would be, hey, in this market, you need to list all your home's assets. And I think that that the fact that ghosts come here is a tremendous asset.
I think a lot of people would probably be dead scared to buy the place if they knew there were ghosts there. There's a lot of fear about them, isn't there?
Well, I think some of it's unwarranted. I think, I think you can read paranormal stuff and scare yourself silly. But I have not, I mean, there's some very good paranormal people out there, and you've got to stay with legitimate, well-established people that aren't trying to take your money. And then there's a lot of people that maybe are less than credible or drawn to it for the wrong reasons. So I think if you're careful and you're smart and you use your good common southern sense, that you're going to do just fine. I don't think it's really anything to be scared about. It's not the other side so much as it's a transition after physical reality. It's just a transition. So I guess I'm not that scared.
Yeah. Final point about your paranormal movie. Just recap there. Did you say you're in the course of making it?
Well, I'm getting all the people together, hiring the actors. The thing is, I wanted to do another apocalyptic zombie movie just to do something really fun, have a fun project. But right after that, I want to do an autobiographical movie about myself called The Accidental Psychic, which will have all my first-person accounts of the paranormal. And that is kind of the, quote, real movie I want to shoot in about a year.
Right.
But I'm writer and I'm producer, and my company's called Broken Desperate Productions, so I'm a psychic with a sense of humor.
Right, Laura. I'm going to have to say thank you very much for a very interesting interview, because our time is up, and I've got about half a minute to announce next week's guest. So thank you very much, Laura. It's been terrifically
interesting. Oh, thank you. Please send me a link to the show. I'll put it on my webpage.
Okay, fine. Right, friends, I think it's a very interesting time. My guest next week will be Lisa Gordon, who's an astrologer and the author of a book called A Sealed Fate. I think she's also an astro agony aunt, so that will be interesting. So thank you for being with me today. I hope you can be with me next week. Thank you very much.